This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, and it is right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you with me for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website, horseracingradio.net. Well, last week, so many of you enjoyed my visit with Kerry Bryan, the former assistant to now retired Hall of Fame trainer Jonathan Shepherd, who burst onto the scene early this year in the Saratoga meet, saddling both the first and second place finishers in the Grade 1 AP Smithwick, which is a prestigious steeplechase race. Well, today I kind of continue with that very same theme as I welcome the 38-year-old native of County Kerry, Ireland, who has been highly successful as a steeplechase rider for more than 20 years and now describes himself as an accidental trainer, which I think is brilliant, after recently saddling his very first career winner on July 23rd at Pimlico. He rode his first winner more than two decades ago and has now won well over 100 races riding over jumps. He is ranked in the top five in both races and money won every year since 2015. Think about that. Twice leading the country in purses earned. Please join me in welcoming trainer slash jump jock Sean McDermott to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Sean, welcome.
Hi, Mike. Thanks. It's great to be speaking to you guys.
Yeah, quite the resume, my friend. It's been quite a ride for you.
Yeah, it's been a good life so far, and long may it continue. We just go with the flow.
You are actually doing the show with me from the barn. You're at Colonial Downs, and you're working with one of your horses there, waiting on the vet to come. So if there is some type of a distraction, we will understand why. But, you know, the job just doesn't ever end for you, does it?
No, but working is a strong term there that I've got away with for a lot of my life. Training horses is definitely different, and it is 24/7, and especially if you have a small number of horses and you're the every job guy. You're the mucking out, you're the groom, you're the rider, the trainer, you do everything. So it's definitely a passion of love rather than for financial gain, that's for sure.
I love the way you referred to yourself as an accidental trainer. What does that mean?
Well, I guess I didn't realize I was saying it, but I've obviously ridden a few hundred winners around the world, and I've seen some very good trainers who struggled maybe financially for one reason or another in different countries, and very talented people. And it was a job I always looked and I thought, oh, that's a tough way to make a living, because I never envisaged myself ever having a trainer's license. And the way it came about was a brilliant man called Mr. Bob Kinsley had bought a farm in Moncton, Maryland. He bought this farm to connect two plots of land so Elkridge Harford Hunt could pass through. And it happened to have a barn, and there was a house and an apartment, and he needed somebody to maybe help him with some yearlings and hunters, and somebody also to rent the apartment. So he contacted me, and that's how it came about. Unfortunately, when we were getting some of his two-year-olds and yearlings broke, Mr. Kinsley passed away. But he had wrote down a plan, and I think he wanted all his horses with us. So I said I'd stick to my word on helping him out, and COVID hit, and I guess I had to I had to progress and run some of the horses. So that's how it came about. Yeah, so definitely accidental.
Have you found training horses and that profession to be as challenging as you thought it might be, Sean?
No, I'm not. I've been around, as I said, horses long enough. I know how difficult it can be. Especially in Ireland and I guess England and places, if you're the jockey, if you're an apprentice or a conditional rider with a bug, as you call it here, you work from the bottom and you work your way up. You don't just come in the morning and get on the horse. There's nobody there with a job title of a groom, because the next kid coming through that gate that wants to be a jockey, they do all jobs, and you learn everything from the bottom up. So, and you work closely with the trainer. So you see every aspect of it. You know, you run the horses as often days as and it still happens. You'll see guys, they might ride in the first race and they'll have to lead up a horse in the third or fourth race, and they'll still be in their breeches, and they might even go back and ride in the fifth race. And these guys are very humble, very, very talented, and it gives you a good grounding. So we've all been through that at home. So, I know how hard trainers work, and everybody looking for that one ingredient, a good horse. So, no, my eyes are definitely open. It's not as easy as people think, you know. So.
Have you enjoyed the challenge?
Almost definitely, yeah. I guess every trainer's in it because they love animals. That's number one. So I love horses and love all animals, really. But yeah, you become friends with the horses and get all their characters a little bit more than you would as a jockey. But I do. I love the challenge, and especially succeeding with the Kinsley family's homebreds, and they're not bred to be superstars, so getting them to achieve their best is very pleasing, you know. And when they try for you, you're kind of more proud of the horse than anything else. Whereas a rider, you're kind of patting yourself on the back, but as a trainer, you're definitely proud of the horse like they're your own kids or something, you know.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've had several trainers come on this show and refer to the horses that they train as their children, and when they see them do well, they're kind of like a proud parent. Sean, how has this affected the amount of time that you can now spend riding horses? I can imagine you don't have that much time to do it anymore.
Yeah, no, I can't. I haven't been to Saratoga this year yet, whereas normally I'd either spend the summer up there or travel up and down it quite a bit. And I've been quite lucky to ride for some very good people, and Jack Fisher and Jonathan Shepherd and you know, Ricky Hendricks. I've ridden winners for many different people up there in the limited number of jump races there is, but I just can't get up there right now. And also I can't get away from the farm to school horses as much as I would like. So that's the riding has definitely taken a back door, but there isn't a huge amount of jump racing in America in a season. So it's something I think I could step back into quite quickly, and I may do next year, you know. So,
how many horses do you have in training, and then the ones that you're working with on the farm? How many total?
There's 11 there total. There's 6 2-year-olds, all quite big actually. So I think maybe 4 will get a start this year, and the other 2 will. They'd have to probably wait until their 3-year-old career, because they're still growing, you know, and their bones haven't closed up yet. And we have a few 3-year-olds, a 4-year-old, and a 7-year-old who's knocking on the door for his maiden hurdle win. And so that's the team, and they'll all find their place, hopefully.
Are the majority of them going to be jump horses, or will they be flat horses?
Originally, Mr. Kinsley, he's the jumping man, and I guess that was his vision, to try and breed horses for jumping. But they will all start on the flat. It gives them a great education, the ones that are ready for it, and they will, I guess, make the transition through then to jumpers if needs be, if they haven't been sold on before that. But, yeah, there's a nice mix there. You know, it keeps things interesting. So we'll definitely cater for whatever's best for the horse.
Visiting with one of the top steeplechase jockeys in the sport, that is Sean McDermott. He is now training horses too, and on July 23rd, he saddled his very first career winner when Favorite Image, a Maryland homebred of the late Bob Kinsley, who you just heard talk about a short time ago, crossed the finish line first at odds of 6-1. Let's go back to that day at Pimlico, Sean. July 23rd, you finally break through with, I guess, your 23rd career starter. Tell me a little bit more about that day and Favorite Image.
Yeah, so Favorite Image is quite a character of a horse, and he's a good story behind him. He, when Bob had asked me to take on this project, he asked me to come and have a look at some of his stock in his farm near York in Pennsylvania, and he had some notes from a previous I guess, advisor or trainer that was working for him, and Favorite Image was on the get rid of list, giveaway for free was actually the comment, because they thought he was a little small. And he subsequently, as a yearling, he managed to stick his foot in a John Deere lawnmower while at Mr. Kinsley's farm. So a very inquisitive horse, and I believe the guys went for lunch and a mower was left in the reach of some of these yearlings, and he was the one that stuck his foot in and gave himself a little scar on the outside of his fetlock, which doesn't affect him, but it could have been very serious. So he carries that scar with him, and we've nicknamed him JD after John Deere. So we're kind of hoping, as John Deere says, we hope he runs like a deer, but... Yeah, so that was his start. So he was an underdog, but I liked the way he moved around the field, and he was a late foal, so I thought he'd grow some more, which he has done now. He's I guess he's reaching above 16.2 at the moment. He's sprung up quite late. We started him on the dirt, and he had a great time out. He didn't try very hard and looked around him. He improved on his second start, and his third start came off the turf, which I kind of fancied him to go close at Pimlico, and but I let it take his chance on the dirt again, and he didn't enjoy it. Went to Penn National, just touched off a nose, so we did fancy him to win at Pimlico, and Kevin Gomez was very clever from the front on him. That was plan A, just to ride a race from the front and save a little bit for a turn and a kick, and he rode him to a tee, so we're very proud of the little horse, you know, so... getting from an underdog to the winner's enclosure with a giveaway horse was a nice feeling. Yeah,
what a great story. I love those kind of stories about horses who, you know, people think very little of early on in their career, and they turn out to prove everybody wrong. You can't, Sean, you can't measure what's inside of a horse, and I'm talking about their heart, right? You just can't measure that.
That's it, you know, and... Every horse is different, and we can all gain experience and listen to great bloodstock agents and whatnot and vets. And, you know, a lot of horses with their legs turned one way or the other are ugly-looking horses. I've seen the backs of a lot of them coming up the home straight. And you might be on the prettiest horse, and but they might be able to run the fastest, and that's what it's all about. So heart is a big thing, definitely, and... yeah, that little guy, he's quite intelligent, so once he figures it out, I think he can win a couple more. You know?
Yeah, it's incredible. How many times do we see horses that sell for $1 million or more, and they don't turn out to be the type of racehorse that would warrant that type of investment, but then we see horses like a Favorite Image who people think, okay, you know, he got hurt, he stuck his foot in a John Deere lawnmower, and we don't think he's going to be any good, and all of a sudden he turns out to be really, really good. That's why people get into this sport, Sean, and I'm sure that's one thing that's keeping you intrigued about training racehorses.
Yeah, that's it. And I guess with a horse like horses like that, they're, of course, you're trying to achieve their ultimate and get them to be the best they can be. But if there was a million-dollar horse in the barn, it also comes with some pressure, I guess. And there's no pressure with these horses, and the Kinsley family are great to support us. And, the horses never know how much they cost. So anybody can go out and buy a winner and win a few races with them. But I think it's the really good trainers can get 100% out of the worst horse and the best horse and place them in the best races. I think that's the key, you know. So, so hopefully we can mirror some of the trainers I've worked for over the years and take a little bit from each of them and get the best out of these guys.
You mentioned the passing of Bob Kingsley a couple of times throughout the show, and he was somebody who was very close to you. I know that had to be difficult. Is his wife, Mrs. Kingsley, is she as interested in the business as he was?
Mrs. Kingsley, a great woman, and I think she was the backbone of the Kingsley operation. And, she's keen on racing, not as much passion as Bob, but that would be very difficult because Bob had an awful lot of enthusiasm, energy, and for life and passion. So he loved his horses and loved his horse racing. So, but thankfully, Mrs. Kingsley's carrying it on in his memory. So it's great that we can get a few winners and make it worthwhile and make it enjoyable for her. But he was a wonderful man. He was very generous and very donated a lot of money and time to people that was never known about and didn't want it to be known about. So that's a great sign of a man. And he was certainly a big loss, not only in the horse community, but definitely in Pennsylvania and Maryland. He did a lot of good for a lot of people. So, but thankfully, his family are carrying on his methods and goodwill. So we remember him well.
Yeah, as you were telling the story in the beginning of the program today about how that relationship came about and how you were introduced to Mr. Kingsley, you talked about the fact that you and your fiance were looking for that apartment or a house to live in. It's, you know, you think about those types of things, Sean, and where you are today. Life is funny, isn't it? The way it takes you on these little journeys. Everything happens for a reason, I guess.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd ridden for Mr. Kingsley, not that much, just a few occasions over the years here. I was generally always booked up and riding for Jack Fisher or Bruton Street or some of those great people. But I rode for Mr. Kingsley in the Gold Cup, a horse called No Wonder, in a stake race. And he missed a hurdle down the back. He stepped, and I was doing a very light weight on him, so the little, I think it was less than a pound saddle on him, just slid to the side, and off I went off the side, an awkward fall or off the back. He stayed on his feet, the horse, but I got a good kicking, and I think I had 9 fractures of 5 ribs and punctured my lung. And unknown to me, Mr. Kingsley was down at the hurdle as I was being, cared to by the medical. Knowing him, he probably made it down quicker than the ambulance. But it's funny how it wasn't long after that he contacted me about the apartment. So maybe I had to break or get 9 fractures to get an opportunity. I'll never know. But it is funny the way it worked out. Yeah.
Wow, 9 fractures. And yet, there is still a big part of you that says, I want to get back on horses and go back over jumps and keep riding.
Yeah, well, as soon as I got out of, first of all, 1 fracture is as bad as 9 fractures because you only feel the most painful one. So regardless of what people tell you and blow up the stories, as dramatic as it may sound, I think they're doing that for a good bar chat. But I got back relatively quickly. I'm not one to lie down in a hospital bed too long, and got back to Ireland and got racing there straight away again. But I think it was maybe 7-8 weeks later, got back riding again in Ireland, and yeah, so I've no fear of riding. I really enjoy it, and look, you could fall off your bicycle in the morning, so the fear hasn't set in yet, which is maybe a pity, but I'll let you know when it does. I'll stop. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You can't ride scared, and you can't have that in the back of your mind. How does a jockey, Sean, after an injury like that, and I know you've probably had other injuries too, but how do you come back and put that out of your mind when you're riding your next races going forward?
I don't know. Is it a thing you learn growing up? But we always played sports when we were small at home, and had a great childhood on a very small farm of our parents. And I guess, like anything, you take a knock in sport, or you, like I said, you fall off your bike, and no mobile phone, so you just get your way home. But I guess I never think about it. Like I said, you could injure yourself in a car crash, but are you going to be scared to get back into the car again? You're probably not. And I think it's the same as riding horses. My good days make up for all the fractures and breaks and injuries I've had, and those things will heal, bones will heal, and I don't feel any the worse for all the injuries I've had. But as long as my head and my brain is good, I'd be happy with, I don't mind the fractures. But sounds a bit weird saying it now, thinking out loud, but you know, it's they say like one in 20 races over as a jump jockey will you fall. That is a statistic. I remember going through a season in Ireland with, I think it was 263 rides and only 3 falls. And the minute I said it to my agent that we got through that season pretty unscathed, I think I got a bunch of falls the following week, and it just I shouldn't have said anything. But no, you definitely don't think about it, because if you start thinking about it, or doubt or lack of confidence, you're not doing your horse justice. So you got to just go with the flow and trust your horse and ride on instinct, I think, you know.
Is there a proper way to fall that you've learned over the years to help you avoid serious injury, Sean? Is there such a thing?
Well, if there is, I should know it by now, but I'm probably the wrong person to ask. In the jockey school in Ireland, the Racing Academy Centre of Education, it's called, they teach you, they have a great strength and conditioning coach called Wayne and Middleton, and he teaches everybody how to fall and tuck and roll properly. And you know, when you build up muscles in the right areas and your back and your neck and your shoulders, you and your core, you definitely helps you recover from falls and take the falls much better. But inevitably, no matter how strong or fit you are eventually going to get the one that will. The ground will be tougher than the human body, so, or the horse kicking you. So, they do teach you a way, but it happens so quick. You know, your brain can't react that quick. You're trying to get in the ball and curl, and you're probably doing it instinctively rather than a thought process going through it.
Yeah, talking with Sean McDermott, who is a steeplechase jockey, now training horses. You heard it, most of that story in the first half of the program. Second half comes your way in just a few minutes. But, Sean, we do have a couple minutes left before we have to get to that bottom-of-the-hour commercial break. I think this is fascinating because the next horse that I ride, other than doing 2 trail rides, is going to be my first. And I can remember riding in the trails with these horses, and they kind of had a mind of their own, and I was scared to death. I cannot imagine what it's like riding these horses, going over jumps, and then having something like that happen where you fall off, and there are horses coming behind you, and the other riders had to adjust, and they don't know. Put me on the other side of things. You already talked about falling, but if you're the jockey who's on the horse coming behind another rider that falls, how do you, I mean, what's the key to making sure that you don't trample that jockey? How do you do it?
Horses are supremely intelligent animals anyhow, so generally they will adjust probably quicker than you can.
Really?
Yeah, they'll already be trying to avoid the falling horse or the falling rider. Sometimes they'll jump the horse or they'll jump the rider. But you obviously react as quick as you can too. You might see a horse maybe make a mistake earlier. That's just taking chances in a race, maybe getting a little bit longer, or maybe standing off too far from a hurdle and it hasn't gone in and adjusted itself to get in close and pop. And usually when they're getting a little bit wild like that, you might just move one foot in or one foot out off its exact track line, and that might help you if that horse either makes a mistake or falls or whatnot. But no, you don't have much time to adjust, but the horse is definitely do a lot of hard work and make the jockeys look good. You said you're scared of trail riding. I wouldn't be the best with heights. And I remember I did a few bungee jumps one time, and I thought the second time I did it, I'd feel better. No, I was absolutely terrified. So we all have our kryptonite, I guess.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And, you know, to hear you tell that story, I have said for years, for more than, well, almost 20 years now doing radio, that that jockeys, pound per pound, are some of the toughest and most fit and strongest athletes that you'll find in all of sports. And when I hear you tell that story about learning a proper way to fall in a race and reaction time and making sure that you don't trample a fallen rider, whatever the situation might be, it just reiterates that point, Sean, that jockeys are such amazing athletes.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to be. The horse is a bigger athlete, but yeah, the fitter you are, the more races you ride, the better you take the falls. And I always look at the jockeys as the tactician and the horse as the athlete. But yeah, you definitely have to be fit, and it's a certain set of core muscles and like different muscles that you use to most other sports, you know. So there's no fitness like race riding really to get you race fit. But yeah, they're definitely quite fit, and especially in this day and age with a better core people around the jockeys, especially at home in Ireland and England. You've dietitians and physiotherapists and all great medical care laid on all for free and encouraged to use it, and it's definitely brought the next generation a step ahead, and I think it shows in the professionalism and the results of those guys. Hopefully America will follow suit and get on board with their flat guys and treat them a little like the professional athletes they are, you know.
Yeah, Sean McDermott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, the longtime top steeplechase rider, now training horses on his own. We'll continue to talk about that in the second half of the program, and we'll take a walk back through some of Sean's early days and talk about some of the places he's ridden, some of the things he's learned that are now helping him with that training career. Stay with me. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This summer, Fasic Tipton celebrates the 100th renewal of the Saratoga Sale, the world's most prestigious auction of selected yearlings in a single catalog. A sale that has produced 100 years of Breed Shapers, Eclipse Champions, Classic Winners, and International Stars. Join us for the Sale of a Century, the 100th Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale, August 9th and 10th in Saratoga Springs, New York. Where will you be?
Consistent success tested over time. There is no better example than Millridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as Pillar of the Turf. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 36 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year. Millridge offers its largest and highest quality consignment ever at this year's Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale, with 9 yearlings by leading stallions and promising first-year sires. And will be showing at Barn 5 on Friday, August 6th. Millridge, standing the test of time. the richest meet in Oak Lawn's history begins Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, May 8th. The 66-day meet will offer more than $45 million in purses with 36 stakes races totaling $12.3 million, and all allowance races are now worth $100,000. Oak Lawn boasts the richest Triple Crown prep series in the country, highlighted by the $1 million Rebel on Friday, February 26th, and the Grade 1 Arkansas Derby Saturday, April 2nd, now offering a purse of $1.25 million. Learn more at oaklawn.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
With a late run. Final 16th of a mile now. Scorpionza stings him here in the Iroquois. Surprising Soul. Moscato up quick closing on the outside.
Well, how about that one for you? Scorpionza getting the victory in the Iroquois Hurdle Stakes. That is a grade one. That was in 2019. It was the second time that he won that particular grade one stakes. He was ridden by Sean McDermott, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you missed any portion of the show, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show, all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, and also follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, and on Instagram. Well, if you are just joining us, Sean McDermott is somebody who has had a ton of success riding steeplechase races, not just here in the United States, but in his native Ireland and all over the world, and he is now training horses, refers to himself as an accidental trainer. This is something he kind of fell into through his relationship with the late Bob Kinsley, and now he is training the Kinsley horses and doing very, very well. He saddled his first winner back on July 23rd at Pimlico, a horse named Favorite Image, who we talked about in the first half of the program, and now looking to add to that success. Sean, how about that little trip down memory lane with that race call for you?
Yeah, it was picking up the commentary, and I was thinking, oh, I know that race. Yeah, no, it was that was a great day, and a great horse. There were some great owners in Bruton Street with Mike Hankins, Charlie Noel, and Charles Fenwick. And yeah, I know that Eric Boy's a fantastic jumps race meeting just south of Tennessee. If you haven't ever been there, I suggest everybody go. It's a great day and a hell of a lot of prize money on, and really showcases the steeplechase sport brilliantly.
You had a lot of success with that horse. It wasn't just those two wins in the Iroquois. Didn't you win the grade one Lonesome Glory with him too?
Yeah, that's right. He won the Lonesome Glory. That was his first grade one. Connor Hankin, which is one of the owners of Bruton Street. Connor would be Mike Hankin's son, a great guy. Had won his earlier hurdle races on this horse, and I guess Connor went and joined the military, which I think he believes he's now is a captain, and I'm sure he'll be a governor someday. He's a very intelligent guy that we look up to. But I inherited the ride from Connor's departure, and so that's how it came about. They have the beautiful big horse, probably not so suited to the really firm ground over here, but he managed to knock out three grade ones, and I believe he's been recently retired. Yep.
Talk about trainer Jack Fisher for a minute. You mentioned you've ridden for him for a while. He's one of the top steeplechase trainers in the sport. Tell me more about that relationship.
Does Jack listen to this show, first of all?
I think he's been known to tune in, so.
Oh, God. Me and Jack have a love-hate relationship, but a lot of respect for each other. Jack's, look, I believe he's nominated for a Hall of Fame this year. He's very good at what he does. Fantastic facility, and he has his methods that he's been doing for years, and obviously they work. We had a lot of success, a lot of winners together, and I'm sure we'll have plenty more in the future. So he was very good to me, as I said, and we talk regular, and it's usually a joke or a smart comment from Jack, and he's a funny guy, you know.
Now that you're training horses, Sean, have you gone to Jack or any other trainers for that matter and kind of picked their brain about different things that might help you be successful on the training side of things?
No, not with Jack. I always used to tell him he was the worst teacher I've ever met. which regards, he'd have maybe have young kids in riding out and helping out, and he'll put them on the toughest horse. And they'll either survive or they won't. If they survive, they'll probably work in the industry for a while. If they don't, it's the next kid. But Jack, you just learn by watching Jack. I've always walked around with my eyes open, and I guess I mainly learned it, ironically, about shipping horses really long distances here and little things like that. Different stuff in the really hot weather, because it's not something we would experience in Ireland. Ireland is only the size of, I believe, North Carolina, so, and you don't have the hot temperatures. So I probably learned a lot of that from Jack, and medications as well. You can use different medications here and stuff like that. But definitely take pieces from him and use it for sure.
What attributes does every good horse trainer possess, Sean? What's the key?
Well, with Jack Fisher, it's perseverance. He works hard through the training season, but I've never seen a man to persevere with a horse as much as him. I guess the ones that are most successful, they never stop thinking about horses, you know, or the horses in their barn, or maybe why did a horse run bad. So they're obsessed a little bit. Might not be great for the family life, but if you're thinking about your horse at 8 or 9 p.m. at night, but I think you nearly have to be a little obsessed. And I think a lot of the really good trainers are, with if they can get a horse to eat a little better, or why the horse run bad, or what mistake they made, and they're not satisfied until they get the best out of that horse. So I would say obsession. And
you think you have that same quality?
I guess the hours I'm working now. I definitely care too much for the horses and not enough for myself. Probably a little bit, a lot of the stuff and hours you work, it's not logical. So you might have to be a little bit of a loony tune in the head as well. I definitely overthink it until I can get it right. But when you do, it's a nice feeling, you know. When you see those horses that you've turned around, and it's only a matter of if they're good enough, then, you know, they will try their best for you when they're feeling, when they're stay healthy and well, and so hopefully it all comes together.
It's great that you mention the hours, because there are people listening, and I think a lot of racing fans that see trainers in the winner's circle all the time, they think, man, that would be so cool, that guy does so great, or that girl does so great, but there is so much that goes on behind the scenes, countless hours that you put in. What's your typical day like, Sean? You mentioned so many hours. What's it like?
I start the barn at 5 a.m. So we feed. And some horses live out at night, so we'll bring them in. And the horses that stay in at night, they'll get turned out in the paddocks for a minimum of 2 hours in the morning, just to have a pig of grass and stretch their legs and be horses again. And I'm basically riding out right through the morning until almost lunchtime. And you know, it's on repeat. Then we're feeding, grooming, you know, all those jobs, cleaning up the barn, and try and grab an hour and a half for lunch if I can, and rest up for a little, do some paperwork maybe, and you're back to the barn at, depending on the heat of the day, but it's generally 3:30, and I try and get finished out of the barn at 6:30, but then I go and attend the farm and the gallops, and try and aerate some grass gallops or pick stones. I've made a wood chip gallop at the farm, a 4-furlong hill wood chip gallop, and yeah, it's a never-ending task. If I can get in by 8 p.m. at night, that's a good goal. If I don't get in at 8 p.m., I'm getting in trouble for not coming in and eating my dinner on time from my lovely fiancée, Jenny. Yeah.
How do you balance that? You have to make time for her and for your family, yet you have to put the time in to make sure you take care of the horses and you're training the horses and giving them their respect. How do you balance all of that?
It's difficult, but Jenny's very understanding and she helps out as much as she can beside her own job. But it's actually very hard to get a good experienced staff at the moment, and I think it's a worldwide problem. So I think a lot of trainers, particularly smaller trainers, are in the same boat. As I said, if you're training 30 horses or 25 horses plus, you can have your foreman and your assistant, and they can, like of today, I'm at Colonial Downs. One of those guys could come down here and do this, and you can attend the morning works and whatnot. But when you have a small number of horses, it's you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. But as I said, the industry is finding it hard to get staff at the moment for, I'm not sure, the COVID-related, was it visa-related applications being held up in America, or is it just people have realized that there's easier ways to make a living maybe? We balance the best we can, but we've got people around us too that understand, you know.
Talking with trainer Sean McDermott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Saddled his very first career winner at Pimlico on July 23rd. He has had so much success in the saddle as a steeplechase jockey all over the world. Sean, take me back to the beginning. Tell me about growing up in Ireland, and tell me where the love of horse racing began for you.
I was born in Tralee in County Kerry, and we live just outside the town. Always had animals on the farm, whether it was horses, cows, sheep. There was bits of everything growing up, so it was a good childhood. Kind of left your own devices, especially during summer holidays from school. I kind of used to go off on your bike and get lost and come back in the evening with cuts and bruises and my mother giving out to me. But, so it was a very good childhood, and my dad always had horses around, show jumping ponies and horses in general, which he used to move on after they became successful. And my older siblings, brothers and sisters, rode a little, and I was the youngest in the family, so obviously it was age related for 12-2, 13-2s and 14-2 ponies. So when my brothers were getting too old, my dad was kind of looking at me thinking, I need to get this guy riding. So that's how it became about. I think he bought me a donkey first to get me riding, because I don't think I was the bravest or the keenest on getting on ponies. But the donkey worked the treat, and before I knew it, I was sitting at the side of arenas for hours with a queue of ponies to ride. Yep. So that's where it became. It all started.
Wow. So your parents would encourage you to go down this path?
My dad, my mom, not so much, I spent many a Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday evening at shows with school in the morning. And again, of course, my mother would want me home doing my homework, and I would be away, maybe 3-4 hours away from home with my dad show jumping. So that was the start of it. So my dad definitely encouraged me. My mom, not so much. Yeah, but eventually I got a little bored of the show jumping and the pace of it, and I went down and cycled down a really thunderstorm wet day, I remember, to a local trainer, Tom Cooper in Ireland, and asked could he give me a job, and I remember him kind of laughing at me at this 12 or 13-year-old kid looking for a job in the rain. He was probably thinking, why didn't he wait till tomorrow when it was dry? But Tom threw me up on a few horses, and I used to get run away with, and all of that carry on. But I loved the buzz of riding the race horses and the power, the speed, and just going racing with them and watching them. So I guess that's where I first grasped the bug and left the show jumping behind a little.
How do you learn to? What's the key to making a horse jump? I mean, again, I've been on two horses in my entire life. So, how does a jockey do that?
Close your eyes and kick him in the belly. No. Look, they're athletes. If the trainer's done his job right and given the horse confidence, they will jump. Some are better than others. Some are more intelligent than others. And you learn to see a stride, and show jumping was a great background for that. So if there's a long stride, you're always wanting your horse to be going forward because it is a race, and you're trying to fill him with confidence. But you're probably setting him up for that stride 10 strides from the obstacle, and the race goer might notice it, or the person in the stands with his binoculars, or the guy watching on television. But you're squeezing with your legs and contact through your hands, and you might, that's giving the horse encouragement and confidence all the way down. And if that stride is there, he's already lengthened his ever so slightly, and he's now met this obstacle and the perfect stride. Whereas if you get down there and you're a little long, you have to be a little bit more forceful to ask him to extend his stride. And if you get down there and you're on a short stride where he has to adjust to come back to you a little bit, he's to shorten his stride. You still have the same grip on him, but you're just sitting a little quieter, and you're maybe talking to him, and just a little slight tap on the reins like you're playing the PlayStation, just very gently, and they should come back if they know their job, you know. And it's all about confidence with a horse, and if you can give him confidence, he'll do very well for you.
Wow, fascinating stuff. Going in the saddle with the outstanding steeplechase rider, Sean McDermott, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. You might be wondering, what are you talking about riding horses so much for? This is a trainer show. Well, he's now training on his own, saddled his first winner a few weeks back, and he's looking for more. Sean, would you prefer to have a stable full of steeplechase horses or flat horses, or maybe a combination?
I think I like the flat racing a little more in America just because it's more professional, but a combination would be good. Steeplechasing is brilliant for horses when they've reached their level as their flat career, or maybe when they've lost interest. You'll often see a horse who was showing a lot of talent as a youngster, and he just kind of fades out, and maybe he's getting a little bit bored of track life, and he goes steeplechasing, and he might be a phenomenon like Snap Decision is a good example. A lot of that is they just really enjoy jumping. It's fun for them. It's like hit a switch in their head. So I would say I'd like a combination of both, but I think they're both good, but steeplechasing definitely has its place for giving the horses a new career and a new interest, and they really enjoy it.
Tell me about the first race you ever rode in.
Oh, Flamenco Fury, I think in the year 2000, maybe, or 1999-2000, at Ferry House race course. I think it was a mile flat race, so I was an apprentice jockey for a while before I shot up and grew too tall and too heavy. But I think I got unseated in the paddock, the parade ring, he reared up, and I think he might have fallen over, the two of us were on the ground. I may have got ran away with going to the start. There's no pony riders in Ireland. and he was quite a free-going little muscle machine of a horse. And yeah, I got in the starting gate, and I remember looking to my left, and it was Stephen John Crane, or Stephen Crane, who was a Group 1 winning rider. And to my right was Mikey Canan, and gates were about to open, the starting stalls were about to open, and you're kind of a bit starstruck. I'm nearly going to ask him for his autograph, and before I knew it, the race was over. And I do remember Mikey Canan was riding a horse from Michael Smurf in the vintage, famous vintage crop colours that won the Melbourne Cup, I believe. And yeah, those colours got very small, so I figured I wasn't winning the race as he disappeared in the distance, and I finished about 11th or 12th, I think. Yeah, I think there might have been maybe 20-something runners, which would be standard at a racetrack of that size in Ireland. So definitely was an eye-opener, let's say.
Wow, what a great story. I love that visual, that picture you painted of the colors on the crop just disappearing into the future as you were fading behind. It's what a great story that was. Sean McDermott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Sean, you then had the opportunity, as you got better, you got more experience, you had the opportunity to ride all over the world. Tell me about some of the places that you've been to in your career.
Well, from a young age, I guess Ireland is known for horse racing. So just from that base, you get to ride in Great Britain. So you get to go to these great festivals like Cheltenham and Aintree, would be the pinnacle of the jump racing festivals in Ireland, or in Europe, I guess, and Punchestown in Ireland. So they're quite close to home. They're just a flight away. So at a young age, I was exposed to that. And I got selected to go to Australia on an Irish jockey team when I was 19 to take on the Australian jockeys. It's called the Irish Aussie Jockey Challenge, and it's a big help to promote racing in Australia. And yeah, that was quite an experience. I think we went out for maybe 2.5 to 3 weeks and rode the tracks in Victoria, close to Melbourne, and in South Australia, so Adelaide and Warrnambool, and all these great race meetings over there. And Australians are very passionate about their racing. It's great fun, and made some great friends, which have subsequently, some have made their way to America and Ireland. And yeah, so that is fantastic. I also got the ride in France, which was quite different in the steep, in the cross country races, and now America as well. So we've tasted a lot of it, but it feels like it's plenty more to experience. Ironically, so maybe somebody will have to stop me. Brilliant.
What does the future hold for Sean McDermott? Are you planning on spending more time training the horses than riding? I know it's tough for you to do both right now, so what does the future hold?
Who knows? I keep training this band of horses, and we'll see what opportunities arise. I'm not finished riding yet, that's for sure. I always said when I'd retire, I'd like to retire in Ireland, so I'd like to go out on my own terms at one of my favorite tracks there if I could. And but this training, as you said, has taken hold, so I don't really know. I keep doing what I'm doing as best I can, and we'll see what happens. Maybe, who knows, maybe a good horse will come along, or maybe a few really good horses will come along and change my mind, and I'll have to stick to the training. But, it's going well at the moment, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, take it as it comes. Down to the final 5 minutes of the show, Sean. I always like to wrap things up by asking trainers to tell me a little something about them we haven't touched on yet, something that people might not know about Sean McDermott. So outside of racing, when you're away from the stable, which, as you just pointed out, it's very difficult to get any time away from the farm or from the racetrack right now, but What other hobbies, interests, things do you enjoy outside of racing?
Well, I love all sports. I admire all professional sports people that it's not easy. I watch most sports, bar cricket, I find. Any they have to go for a lunch break during cricket, and any time you have to go and eat some sandwiches at half time, it doesn't grasp me as a proper sport. But and actually, aviation, I love aeroplanes as well, and flying aeroplanes. And there was a time, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was half thinking of going down that route. Not because I disliked racing, but it was... if you were to be a commercial pilot and get the experience, it was kind of, that was the age or time to do it. So I worked on getting a private pilot's license, but that has left a kind of lapse in the last couple of years. It's just been too busy, but I can resurrect that again. But yeah, love flying planes, and the aviation has fascinated me a little bit. So I'm not sure too many people would get in a plane with me, but yeah, that's more fun for me.
Well, Sean, listen, it has been so much fun to hear your story. It is such an interesting story, and I know that no matter what you choose to do in the future, whatever comes along, you're going to be successful because you're a winner, and you will continue to be that going forward. Thank you so much for telling your story here on Trainer Talk today, and all the best with your future stable and with your riding career. Safe trip every time you get a leg up.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for the kind words, Mike, and thank you for having me.
All right, Sean, enjoy it. Sean McDermott here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Yeah, what a great story, and so nice of him to join me. Again, he was at the barn at Colonial getting ready to have the veterinarian come and administer Lasix and all those types of things. Of course, recording the show prior to the 6 Eastern start time that you're listening. But what an interesting visit and an interesting conversation with Sean McDermott here on Trainer Talk tonight. If you missed any portion, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can get the podcast at your leisure. You can also follow us on social media at HRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and on Instagram. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to this edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. I'll talk to you next week.